Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Get around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 176 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, exclusively here and only here on the listener-supported Head On Radio Network, also brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch at crmw.net. Please stop by crmw.net, Coal River Mountain Watch, and see for yourself what mountaintop removal is doing to West Virginia. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day, today being Friday, August 15, 2008. So if you're listening shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern Time on a Friday evening in the hot month of August, August the 15th, you are indeed listening to a live show, and you're more than welcome to participate with myself and the amazing guest, whom I'll be introducing shortly. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and it's there that you'll find links to all of the guests, and you'll find links to the audio archives from past shows, as well as to our chat room, which is active as we speak. There are also links there for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to help you locate the music that you hear on the show. You'll find there also a link to the main network site, which is headonradionetwork.com. And at headonradionetwork.com, you can find out about all of the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network, of which I am only a small part. You'll also find there the PayPal button to make it easier for you to support the Head On Radio Network and progressive radio that you can't get anywhere but here. Unique, absolutely unique. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4, Head On. That's 877-443-2366. If you have unlimited long distance, you could use that. It's area code 304-658-3333. 304-658-3333 rings in West Virginia, and either Agnes or Bob at the studio will grab the call. The toll-free line again is 877-443-2366. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com. That's Peter at headonradionetwork.com. And I do try to check the email during the evening. And so there you have three ways you can participate with the show. You can drop an email, you can call in and join us on the air, or you can drop into the chat room. There's a link to the chat room at strictlyconfidentialradio.com. It's very simple. Just click on the chat room link and register yourself a chat name, and you'll fall right into the chat room. It's very easy. No muss, no fuss. One comment about the broadband service here. It has been problematic for the last couple of weeks. It seems to have stabilized at a really fast rate. It's just amazing. Actually getting the service here that we're paying for. So that's great news. That takes a lot of headaches out of the circuit. I want to introduce you to our guest that we have this evening. I'm delighted to have John with us this evening. That's John Lauritsen. One of our longtime listeners suggested John as being a guest in the show, and
I'm glad that listener did. John has been active in the gay liberation movement since the summer of 1969. He is a gay scholar, a historian, an AIDS activist, and recently acquired some national notoriety for writing that Percy Shelley, not his second wife, is the author of Frankenstein. That will be interesting to find out more about. John was born and raised in Nebraska. He graduated from Harvard in 63 and lived in New York from 63 to 95, then Provincetown, and now lives in Dorchester, which is a part of Boston. Again, he is a gay activist and scholar since the earliest days of gay liberation. He was with Gay Liberation Front and edited their publication called Come Out. He also is a member of Gay Activists Alliance, and he served as a delegate at large. He was a member of Gay Academic Union, of which he later became the national director. He was also known within the gay rights movement beginning in about the 70s as an opponent of religion, and in 1974 published a pamphlet called Religious Roots of the Taboo on Homosexuality, which became an underground bestseller. He and a colleague also became severe critics of the late John Boswell's best-selling book, Christianity, Social Tolerance, and Homosexuality, which was then and still to a large degree is a guide, if you will, for gay Christians as to reconciling oneself with the teaching of the church, and historically speaking. Also, with the advent of AIDS, he wrote many articles about the AIDS epidemic and was highly critical of some of the activities and studies. The Sunday Times in London says that they were the most trenchantly informative, irreverent, funny, and tragic writings of the AIDS years. Couldn't be happier to have you on the show, John Lauritsen. Welcome to Strictly Confidential.
Good evening, Peter. I'm glad to be here.
Good evening, John. John, first of all, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir, I can hear you fine. And if that changes any at all during the course of the show, you just speak up, and the studio's got plenty of knobs and dials, and they can fix it right up for us, okay?
Okay.
Okay. John, I'm amazed. After looking through the materials, the websites, the links that your site links to, I'm just blown away. I have to tell you, the listeners, we're always fascinated by people who are aware of gay history. We've had a couple of people who have told us what they know regarding historical facts about LGBT folks, and it's wonderful to have you as a guest. But I've got to tell you, I want to talk about everything from the first politician to speak out for homosexual rights to Boswell, all the way through your book about Frankenstein. I don't know how we're going to do it in 2 hours.
There's a lot of ground.
It certainly is.
A lot of controversial positions. And, there are advantages and disadvantages. Sometimes people like to discredit one position because of some stand I've taken on a totally different issue. And it seems that, even though one is allowed maybe to take one controversial stand, if you take more than one, people will come up to you and they'll look at you strangely with sort of a glittering eye, and they will say, "Do you believe in conspiracy theories?"
And oh, yeah.
Question, what do you say?
Well, there really isn't a good answer to that. If you're right, you're so right. If you challenge more than one of the conventional mores, you eventually get called a conspiracy theorist or a fringe element, etc. But, this year we have – our listeners are some of the smartest people on the planet, and we can handle it, so we could go through any of them you like.
Well, let me see. I haven't been writing a great deal on AIDS for some time, mainly because there haven't been openings. I was very lucky in the 80s and early 90s that the New York Native published about 50 of my articles, and they were very, good to work for. But they were driven out of business by a boycott organized by the so-called AIDS activists. And since then, I've taken what opportunities there are, but there's a type of censorship on AIDS that is as powerful as any type of censorship in the world, really. Occasionally there are little breakthroughs, but then, you know, quickly the cracks in the wall are sealed up again, and that's the end of it.
Very interesting. And in the beginning, you were publishing information regarding perhaps the use of poppers was linked to the AIDS epidemic, and here more recently there's stories which are always swept into the corner that it had to do with government tests of a hepatitis vaccine. If I got that right, I would. Do you know about that? Because it's terribly interesting to me.
I wouldn't say I'm really that informed on it. I mean, I'm highly skeptical of all these things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you were publishing for the paper there in New York. They published about 50 articles in New York Native. Was it the result of the articles that you wrote, which was one of the reasons that they got sort of pushed to the side? Were people just not ready for what you were saying?
Well, pushed aside, it was a very organized boycott by ACT UP primarily, and eventually it succeeded. I mean, the New York Native was the world's number one gay newspaper for, I would say, about a decade. It was sold all over the world and had, for a gay newspaper, a very large circulation. But eventually, you know, advertisers were driven away and it folded.
I see. And what was it like during the early days? It was not being talked about at the national level. It was, in fact, I believe it was Reagan in charge at the time who made a huge point of not ever mentioning it.
Well, yeah, I mean, the AIDS thing is a long, long discussion. My position, which took me a while to arrive at, but it would be now, is that there's no such thing as AIDS as a coherent disease entity. It's not like measles or chickenpox. It's a construct, and it's a phony construct. The definition has changed very radically over the years. The early cases, the first, say, 50, 100, cut 200 or so, were very, very sick people, and they were sick for reasons which were really pretty obvious once you started finding out the facts about them. But that changed, and with the constant revisions of the definition of AIDS, you can now have an AIDS diagnosis with hardly being sick. And the AIDS diagnosis has been supplanted by an HIV-positive diagnosis, which is based on tests which have never been validated. Validated is a technical word, but when you validate a test, it means that you ask the question, what is it that this test measures? Not how well it does, how accurately or reliably, but simply what? And in the case of the ELISA test and the Western blot test, we do know things they measure. There are about 60 different conditions that will cause a positive reading. Anything from alcoholism to drug abuse to previous infections with malaria to all kinds of things which have nothing to do with a retrovirus. But people are, once they get a positive result on these worthless tests, and worthless, I think nobody should ever take one. No one should ever allow, you know, the test to be given. Once somebody's considered HIV positive, and it's really only gay men that are targeted for testing, then they're given drugs, and the drugs slowly but surely, will kill them off. Here in Massachusetts, the largest cause of death for people who are HIV positive is liver failure. But liver failure is not an AIDS-defining condition. So therefore, the people never had AIDS. They had an HIV-positive result on these phony tests. They were given drugs with terrible toxicities. they died of liver failure caused by the drugs. And that's the end of it. But they never got AIDS because they never developed one of the AIDS conditions.
Yes, I understand. I should tell you that I was diagnosed in 96, and at that time I was diagnosed with PCP pneumonia, and in fact the doctor walked into the hospital room and said, "Mr. Godbole, you have AIDS. It's the advanced stages, and it's terminal." And well, you know, that was pretty scary. And it was just the next month, I believe it was December or January of 97, that the first of the cocktail type treatments came out, and I'm still alive and kicking. But I have to tell you, they check my liver function quite often.
Well, yes. The fungal infections thing, I have a friend who just got out of the hospital, and he's not in good shape, but they gave him powerful antibiotics there. And one of the expected things of antibiotics is that they cause fungal infections. Thrush, PCP would be a likely result, but they never tell them things that would be common sense in terms of alternative health measures. In other words, take probiotics, which restore the bacteria in the intestines that the antibiotics killed off. And it's the friendly bacteria that keep the funguses, which are there always, in check. But I have never heard of a mainstream doctor who said something as simple as eat a lot of yogurt or, take the probiotics, which would be things like Acidophilus and there are a number of preparations like that.
Interesting. I never got that advice back in those days, and certainly I went through the whole thing with thrush and all of the nasty little things that can happen. But no, I never heard anything about eating yogurt.
Well, it has to be plain yogurt, no sugar. Sugar is bad for anyone with a fungal infection. But the probiotics, most bacteria would be killed by the acid in the stomach. So if you get one of the preparations, they have a coating which allows it to get beyond the stomach before it's released. So of course, now I'm playing doctor, which I really shouldn't.
Well, is it because you are taking an anti-establishment or a different point of view of HIV and of AIDS at the time that there were people who were boycotting? Was it that they thought you were bad for gay people because you were presenting an alternative point of view?
Some people that way, but I would say that on the main, that the so-called AIDS activists were phonies. They were, in fact, representatives of the drug industry. And, of course, one of my major accomplishments was to establish beyond any doubt that the phase two trials of AZT were fraudulent. And this I did with documents that were released under the Freedom of Information Act. And I go into great detail there, but let's just say the cheating of every imaginable type took place there, and the results of the test were utterly worthless, and yet it was the basis for the FDA allowing AZT to be marketed. AZT is a terrible drug. It's a poison. It's by far the most toxic drug ever approved for long-term use, and it has absolutely no benefits of any sort whatever that have ever been demonstrated.
Interesting. One of the concoctions that I take, Lord, there's so many. One of them is called Tricor, and I believe AZT is a part of it. I take three of them. They're three different flavors. And frankly, AZT proved itself to so many people died just taking AZT. It really is demonstrated from the deaths that it wasn't effective.
Well, yeah, it's the CDC. statistics, which I followed very closely for many years. And then they stopped, they started changing the rules. They stopped reporting things they had previously. So it became utter chaos, and it would be impossible to really track information the way that it was for a while. But let's say that from 1987, when ACT was approved for marketing, I once figured it out. This was a number of years ago. Even a number of years ago, 97% of all of the AIDS deaths occurred after ACT was approved for marketing. So most of us have the image of the early AIDS cases. But in terms of the bigger picture, they were very few and not at all typical. The typical AIDS cases would be people who were basically poisoned by ACT, the other nucleoside analogs, and now the protease inhibitors.
Go ahead. I'm just thinking in terms of all of the medications that, you know, the doctors come up with these treatment plans, and they mix and match all these different very powerful medications together, and it's hard to know whether they're doing the right thing or not. It's interesting that you'd point out that so many people in Boston are dying of liver failure.
Well, if you grasp the basic concept, AIDS is not an infectious disease. AIDS is not caused by any microbe, virus, bacterium, or anything like that. Therefore, it makes no sense whatever to take any medications that are predicated on trying to kill an infectious agent. I mean, people who are sick, who've earned an AIDS diagnosis, are sick for specific reasons. They're not necessarily sick for the same reasons, and they're not necessarily sick in the same way. But the thing is to find out what those reasons are. In the case of, say, a heroin user with lung disease, which could include various forms of pneumonia and tuberculosis, this is an expected consequence. It's been known for 100 years and more that people who take heroin and similar drugs die from lung failure. And there are very good reasons for it. I mean, the heroin destroys the immune system, and it also destroys the lung function, which is partly why codeine was used as a cough suppressant. But in larger doses, of course, the lungs fail to function, and the result is death from pneumonia.
Very interesting. I should make a clarification. Earlier in the conversation, I referred to Tricor, and indeed I take that too, but that's the medication I'm referring to is Trizivir, just in case anyone caught that. That's just to point that out. Bob, let's talk about you're going into the Gay Liberation Front. This was prior to the mid-70s. This was around 69 or so. I remember the Gay Liberation Front from when I was a teenager. There was a small group in Tallahassee, and we met at a lesbian's house, and we talked about meetings and what have you. In fact, the group itself marched in an ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment parade. There were so many things. Those were such heady times, but it had to be very different in the big city. What was the Gay Liberation Front and moving into that in New York like in 1969?
Well, I had some contact with the earlier homophile movement in Boston when I was in school. I went to Harvard and lived for a while in Boston. There was a group called, at one time, the Boston Chapter of the Mattachine, and another group called the Boston Demophile Society. Demophile, I'm still not sure how to explain what it was supposed to mean.
Yes, I've been lost.
I merely attended meetings. I wasn't active. But the Gay Liberation Front came into being a couple of weeks after the Stonewall riots in June of 1969. And I had been active in the anti-war movement, and so I was more than ready for it. I mean, I had been very conscious as a gay man, though as a gay person ever since my adolescence. And I had read what was there, and I was ready for a group which would fight for gay rights without any of the usually more or less apologetic opposition that the homophile group had taken. And, you know, since the July of 1969, when I attended my first meeting, it's more or less been the course of my life in one way or another, gay liberation.
I see. And you're actually the national director of the Gay Academic Union. What is the Gay Academic Union?
I was one of the national directors, not
the... Ah, okay. Not the...
Not quite.
What is it? I'm not familiar with the organization.
Well, it's defunct. It existed from, most of the 1970s. It was a group mostly of academics, although not entirely. It was a group of scholars, and its function basically was to foster gay scholarship and also to provide once a year a conference where, you know, which would be a forum for gay scholars. It was somewhat superseded later by a Columbia seminar on homosexualities, which went through, I don't know the exact dates, a good part of the 80s and early 90s. And then there have been various other groups of gay academics now.
Well, you mentioned Stonewall. We've mentioned many times in the show that there actually were gay people before Stonewall. There seems to be the common impression that gay people just suddenly appeared on the planet and just popped into existence for Stonewall. That was the beginning. Yet you trace the first politician back to 1898, which is fascinating. Please tell us about that.
Well, I keep going further and further back. David Thorstedt and I wrote a book which was published in 1974 called The Early Homosexual Rights Movement, 1864 to 1935. And by 1864, we used an incident where Karl Heinrich Ulrichs, who became a very prominent gay scholar, took the floor of a meeting of lawyers in Germany and brought up the question of, well, basically abolishing the sodomy statute, and he was shouted down. But it's hard to tell, you know, what the first actual gay action would be, but it comes as close as any. But for earlier, I keep discovering earlier and earlier forms of either gay men, you know, thinking about working for gay freedom or actual essays and polemics. Jeremy Bentham, the well-known philosopher, wrote an essay in the late 18th century on pederasty, and it was never published. It wasn't published until, late in the 20th century, because he very correctly was afraid, you know, of the consequences. But it's a very fine essay. Like many of them, it uses ancient Greece as sort of a touchstone because, here's the situation. A lot of gay guys growing up think, you know, why does everyone hate us? And it's as though gay men, you know, always and everywhere had been, you know, the subject of hatred. And that was not at all the case. I mean, in the ancient world, and Greece and Rome and in many ancient cultures untouched by Judeo-Christianity, sex and love between males was perfectly normal and accepted. And in ancient Greece, it was very highly regarded. I guess my point would be that many of the early gay men who were thinking about it, like Jeremy Bentham, used ancient Greece as a type of argumentation. Later in the 19th century, John Addington Symonds wrote a book, A Problem in Greek Ethics, which I think is still, well over a century after it was written, in some ways is still the best treatment of male love in ancient Greece. Right now I'm doing a great deal of research and writing on the Shelley-Byron circle, Lord Byron and Percy Bysshe Shelley, the two leading poets of English Romanticism, and the
yes.
circle of male friends.
Interesting.
And Shelley himself wrote an essay which, in a very tentative way, argued for the validity of male love. And I make the case in my book, The Man Who Wrote Frankenstein, that on one level, Frankenstein is very much about romantic male friendship, male love, as it were. And that for all of the time, that there have been hundreds, actually thousands of critical studies of Frankenstein, a few people have rather, snidely noticed what they call homosexuality or homoeroticism, but they make nothing of it. I mean, it's there in front of their face, and they just, deliberately or not, they avoid commenting on it.
Well, it's interesting because the teaching that it was not Percy Shelley that wrote Frankenstein, that it was his first wife or second wife. That seems to be such a big deal amongst in teaching it. See, I remember. Look, here's why I say that. I remember being taught that as early as junior high school. It just seems to be a huge deal. How is academia reacting to your publishing this?
Well, they've reacted rather brutally. I've taken a hell of a lot of abuse, although there have also been people like Camille Polyuk who have rallied to my support. But, of course, Mary Shelley is considered the author. I mean, Shelley did not want to be known as the author, and Frankenstein was published anonymously in 1818. And first of all, he simply told a few people that it wasn't his book, that it was simply the work of a friend. Then Shelley rather tentatively, and in my opinion stupidly, told a few people that Mary Shelley was the author. But it didn't get very far. Some people saw through it, like Sir Walter Scott, who reviewed it. And it didn't matter that Shelley told him he wasn't the author. Scott saw very clearly, and he knew Shelley's writings, that in fact Shelley was the author. But it changed. Shelley died in 1822 in a boating accident, along with his friend and lover, Edward Ellicott Williams. Shelley was not quite 30 years of age. And Mary Shelley was stranded in Italy. She had no money to get back to England. So in 1823, they were going to put on a play in London on Frankenstein. So Mary Shelley's father, who is in a lot of ways the leading figure and almost a villain in some way, put out a new edition of Frankenstein. And he saw that on the title page in all of the advertisements, it gave the author not as anonymous, but as Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley. And his reasons for doing it are actually rather obvious. I mean, the true author was dead. The goose who laid the golden eggs was dead. But Godwin saw that by creating the myth that Mary Shelley was the author of what was a best-selling work, it would be the possibility for more novels to appear, as by the author of Frankenstein, which, in fact, they did appear. And Mary Shelley could try to write them, although she really was a terrible writer. But she didn't have to, because Godwin could write them for her. at least this is what I think was his reasoning. I can't prove this, but a great deal of the evidence has been destroyed, and so, you know, there's not too much you can do.
But I see. Well,
yeah.
Go ahead, please. I was just going to point out that some say that they attribute that she wrote it because some of it was in her handwriting, and I believe you point out that's because she took dictation or took notes.
Well, yes. I mean, Mary Shelley was adopted by the academic feminists in the 1980s. And, you know, she appeared, Frankenstein appeared in hundreds of syllabi in academia. And they loved it because Frankenstein basically is a rather masculine work. And the idea that this powerful, rather masculine work could be written by a teenage girl, was very thrilling to feminist sensibilities. But the argument against her authorship, I mean, there are two arguments. One is a positive, and that is that Frankenstein is not a terribly easy work, but it's also one that has a mass appeal. But on every page, it has the signature of Percy Bysshe Shelley, I mean, who is, after all, one of the greatest poets in English. It has the rhythms of his prose style. It has the type of symbolism that you would find in his poetry. It has the ideas, the radicalism that is Shelley. In every way, it bears a signature. The negative case that Mary Shelley did not write it comes from simply looking at the works, and there are a lot of them that she wrote, that we know that she wrote on her own without help from anybody at all, from her father or from her husband. And these are pathetic. I mean, they show a woman who can hardly put together a good sentence, let alone a good paragraph. The real Mary Shelley style is sentimental, awkward, ungrammatical, affected. It's everything that Frankenstein is not. It's not a difficult case. It's really rather black and white. I mean, she could not have written what is, after all, a masterpiece of English prose. But, you know, I have not been... A lot of very important reputations are, to some extent, based on the Mary Shelley myth. And the graduate students and junior faculty member waiting for tenure are scared to death of confronting the big guys, the ones with tenure, who can give, you know, who can decide basically if they themselves will get tenure or even will doctorate. So that's part of it. Part of it is emotional. I mean, there have been blogs in which I've been accused of being a homosexual, a geek, a misogynist, a schlub, that means an idiot of sorts, I guess, and all sorts of other things. All of these by people who have absolutely no intention of ever reading the book. It's just off the top of their head. They, you know, it's as though you were assaulting a woman or something, and they are gallantly coming to the defense of it. And yet, in my opinion, that's absurd. I mean, either she was capable of writing it or she wasn't.
Well, John, I want to ask you. You mentioned tenure, and interestingly enough, in the review from Salon by Camille Paglia, I believe it's pronounced, she pointed out that your book is important not only because of its audacious theme, but for the devastating portrait it draws to the insularity and turgidity of the current academics and. And that you were, in fact, an independent scholar, and so you are not threatened by bringing up controversial issues regarding this. But yet you're saying that this is right in front of everyone's face, but nobody wants to deal with it.
Yes, I would say so. I've taken enough flag from academia. I'm ready to strike back, you know, on my own terms. But anyway, I have time to do it. Oh, I left off handwriting. I can make that very, very simple. There's a manuscript mostly in Mary Shelley's handwriting, except for a few thousand words in Shelley's, called the Frankenstein Notebooks. And the the advocates of her scholarship, of her authorship, have said this is proof positive, it's in her handwriting, that this is asinine and ridiculous because Mary Shelley routinely did copy work from Shelley. In other words, she would scribble something and she would put it in nice, neat handwriting. She also took dictation from it. She also did copy work for Byron, and she did copy work for Thomas Love Peacock, a friend of Shelley's. So the fact that something is in her handwriting means absolutely nothing at all, one way or the other. It's so simple. That's all you need to say on it. But they will not admit they were wrong about anything, even something this simple.
I see. I want to ask, do you think that part of the reason that that it was shifted toward a female writer rather than the male, you've mentioned a male love theme that is embedded or woven into the book itself, into Frankenstein, and do you think that was part of it to attribute it to a female writer so that it would be more acceptable?
Shelley published some things under a pseudonym, for example, very well-known sonnet, Ozymandias. There's nothing about it that's personal. There's no reason he couldn't. He just did under a pseudonym. A poem, Epipsychidion, is extremely personal. And he not only published that anonymously, but he was terribly concerned that it should only be given to what he called the esoteric few. Well, as one gay man to another, esoteric few suggest what you think.
I say bullseye. Oh, that's funny.
But anyway, on my website, I have an analysis of Epipsychidion and the homoeroticism. But Frankenstein, yes, male love is very powerfully there, and that might have been an issue. But he may also merely have wished it to be anonymous. He may have considered a novel and entertainment somewhat beneath him, you know, as a philosopher and a poet. That's possible. I don't know, really. But it was Godwin who really got it in motion. And in his case, it was money, money, money. Godwin was always in need of money and a very venal man, and that was surely his main motivation.
I see. Well, I'm now that you're mentioning these things, as I look back on Frankenstein, in fact, he did love his monster, and then in fact, the villagers did kill the monster and the pitchforks and the whole. It does sound a little bit familiar to the gay experience.
Well, yes. There's an ambivalence towards the monster, and towards the end of the novel, it's not entirely sure that the monster actually exists outside the mind of Victor Frankenstein. It's an amazing novel. I mean, it brings in elements of surrealism and things which we think of as being relatively modern in the novel. But in terms of the male love thing, I mean, this is there from almost the first few pages. Something that the critics tend to completely skim over, which is the a young man, Captain Robert Walton, who rescues Victor Frankenstein up in the Arctic regions where Frankenstein has been pursuing the monsters, almost dead, and so on and so forth. And a good part of the early part of Frankenstein is the expression of Robert Walton of his need for a friend, and it's extremely homoerotic, very, very straightforward. I mean, he needs a man whose eyes would reply to him, who would be his companion and all the rest of it. And Frankenstein and Walton do bond. It's a rather touching relationship. Frankenstein, at the end of it, dies because he, you know, was simply too weak from the shock he'd experienced, pursuing the monster, but throughout it, there are expressions. There are several sets of male couples, and there's a very idyllic relationship between Victor Frankenstein and his best friend, Henry Clerval. And I wouldn't even say it's camouflage. I mean, there's a little discretion. It's obviously not hardcore, but still the emotional aspects of a relationship are quite clearly there. But critics, they want to look upon it as a woman's novel, and so they ignore all of this. And they try to imagine the novel is about a man who's trying to have a baby without a woman. Well, huh. I mean, okay.
Yeah, that doesn't ring a bell with me. Doesn't sound very... Well, it's most interesting, really. One wonders if the academia doesn't want to acknowledge it simply because they've been wrong for so long. Do you think that's part of it, almost to go so simple as to say it's just pride?
Well, not all of them. It's like a club. I mean, I could say a few of them, you know, where their reputations would fall completely if Mary Shelley's authorship was, you know, eventually denied. But others, they're simply friends, you know, the Charlie, Don, Nora, you know, type of club. And it may be that only Charlie and Nora, you know, have reputations would fall, but maybe a dozen of their good friends, you know, would feel sorry for them. I mean, I have been told that I was trying to destroy the reputation of a scholar simply because of making my simple little point about handwriting.
I mean, I see.
If you can't do that, what can you do? I mean, in academia.
I see. So this is almost sacred ground, then, that you're disturbing bringing up these points. And speaking of sacred, tell us about Boswell and the fact that apparently in the 70s you were viewed as a, an opponent of religion, and certainly around here we feel the wrath of the Fred Phelps and the American Family Association and the James Dobson, so we tend to agree. What was that like in the mid-70s, though, to be known as an opponent of religion?
There was a group of gay scholars. I mean, my idea of scholarship is that one simple word is paramount, and that's truth. I mean, the model of Harvard is veritas, truth in Latin. And there were some of the gay scholars that wanted to make Boswell into a gay hero. And Boswell was very good-looking, blonde, blue-eyed, sort of a Beach Boy type, well, and very, very seductive. So they all were enamored of him, and they didn't like what we said because we pointed out that on certain issues he was wrong. Not everything by any means. His magnum opus is an important work of scholarship. But I wouldn't say it's entirely only that I'm an opponent of religion. It's that the Abrahamic religions, which would be Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, are all anti-gay, and they're anti-gay because they all go back to a single taboo, which is the Holiness Code of Leviticus. And never came out 1822, I think, in some other chapter. But it prescribes a death penalty for males who have sex with each other. And in the 2,500 years since Holiness Code of Leviticus was formulated, the taboo is very consistent. In the American colonies, some of them didn't even bother having a law on sex between males. They simply plugged in the verse from Leviticus, and that was it. Males caught having sex with each other were killed. And that was true in England. Men and boys up until 1834 were hanged for having sex with each other, whereas in countries under the Napoleon Code, which was from 1810, it was perfectly legal for males to have sex with each other, which, among other things, is why Byron, Shelley, and an awful lot of gay men chose to live in Italy, where it was entirely legal. But that sure got off of it.
Very interesting.
But other religions, I mean, you can't say that the Olympian religion, the religion of ancient Greece, was anti-gay. Of the various gods in the Olympian religion, I think that Ares, the god of war, was the only one that didn't have a known male lover. All of the others did, from Zeus, who abducted Ganymede, down to all of the other ones. And the point Jeremy Bentham made in the 18th century is that obviously if the gods themselves indulged in this behavior, there's no way that the general population could have disapproved of it.
Well, tell us about Boswell's book, that Christianity, Social Tolerance, and Homosexuality, and it's said here that it was when it was written, and still to a degree is the Bible for gay Christians. What was it that Boswell said? That can you give us a synopsis of what Boswell got wrong?
Yeah, I want to give the address for my website, because it has links to the critique we made of Boswell and all of these other things. But basically, for me, the thing was that Boswell said there was absolutely nothing inherently anti-gay about Christianity, that it was only in the late 12th century, whatever, that any type of homophobia developed. And this is simply untrue, because from the very beginning, Christianity was extremely hostile to all forms of paganism, to all forms of sexual expression, and especially to sex between males. And in fact, when Christianity became the state religion of Rome in the 4th century, the institution of the death penalty for sex between males was one of the most noteworthy events. Before that, there had been nothing even remotely like that. But Boswell, I wouldn't hesitate to say that he believed so strongly in his case that he became actually dishonest on a number of occasions.
I see. Boswell was a teacher, was he? Was he a college-level teacher?
Well, Boswell was a history professor. On the success of the book, he became the chair of the history department at Yale. No, he was an important scholar.
And so here again we have an instance of a person, a position of not wanting to be challenged because of his stand amongst the other professors
engage in dialogue. I mean, we gave him every opportunity to respond in written form or any other form, and he simply evaded them. He never did, and of course he died still young of so-called AIDS.
I see. Very interesting. I remember back when that book, it was in the 80s, I actually bought a copy of that book, a very thick book. But I have to tell you, I never, ever got around to reading it. I just couldn't bring myself to read it. There's always something else going on. I congratulate you for even reading it. But I've got to tell you, boy, what a book that was. I've got it around here somewhere.
It's well written for what it is. The best chapter is the one on Rome. And that's excellent. There's nothing I would really object to there. He takes, scholars have always tried to imagine there was something called the Lex Scantinia, which was allegedly an anti-gay law in ancient Rome. Well, it's made up out of whole cloth. There's absolutely no truth to it whatsoever. Nobody knows what the Lex Scantinia really was or what it said. But it's impossible that it could have outlawed sex between males in ancient Rome. I mean, there's too much evidence contrary to it. And Boswell makes a very powerful case against the traditional homophobic scholars who, had this, call it mythical, Lex Scantinia.
Interesting. Well, one of the... In fact, it may have been that one. It's a book you wrote or at least a pamphlet you wrote with David Thorstad, and I believe it was regarding gay conservatism. Was it called Queer Wars?
I did a review of a book called Queer Wars.
I see. There was a project that you wrote with David Thorstad, and I'm not sure which one that was. Do you recall?
I don't have the first book we co-authored, the only one we co-authored, is the Early Homosexual Rights Movement, 1864. And that brought up people in the American homophile movement believed that the first time homosexuals ever got together in the history of the world was in 1950. And, of course, that wasn't true at all, because starting in 1897, there was a large, powerful gay organization called the Scientific Humanitarian Committee, and then many other spin-off groups. But they were totally unaware of them, with maybe one or two exceptions like Jim Kepner. But it opened up a whole new field of scholarship. We had to, most of the reading we did was in German, and the yearbooks of the Scientific Humanitarian Committee were a wealth of information. But we did very, very intensive thing, because both of us were working at the time, too, so we had to do all of our research in our spare time. I don't know how we did it. Somehow we did. It's a very small book.
I see. Well, what was it like working with him? I'm looking at an article that he wrote called Balls and Chains, and he seems example, there's a quote, all the arguments in favor of marriage, meaning gay marriage, ring hollow and mask an agenda that has nothing to do with equality or fair treatment, let alone liberation. I'm trying to understand the man and what it was like working with him. Was he an ultra conservative, or what are your thoughts about him and some of his statements in Balls and Chains?
Both David and I were socialists back in at that time. I don't have a firm position on gay marriage, but I do believe that it should not be the number one issue of the gay movement. I think David makes a number of strong arguments against it, like, what about the rights of single people, of which I'm one? What about the idea that sex is good for its own sake, sex for the sake of sex? If you have a gay marriage, then what, you have gay divorces? You have to have gay monogamy? I don't know. I'm just asking questions, but it seems to me that,
Well, I was about to point out that I have echoed sentiments along those lines. In fact, we talk about that to a degree on some of the shows on the Head On Radio Network. Example, the environment and what's happening with planetary systems at this point makes no difference, really, if we can get married. If 20 years from now we're all going to be dead, there is a certain priority to things. Is that part of your feeling?
The more you think about any issue at all, it's just the simplest thing, in terms of energy, is that we've got to start using less of it. But you make the simplest, most practical thing, saying that public buildings in the winter should no longer be overheated. I mean, you go to a public building, it might be heated to 75, whereas a much better temperature would be 65 or less, better for your health, better for everything. But there will always be a few people who will complain bitterly, and they will claim that they are cold if it's less than 75. But, in the northern state, every degree that you heat, a building up very drastically increases the rate of heat loss. And therefore, an awful lot more oil, which is going to, I don't know how I will heat my house this next coming winter, the price of oil.
You wrote And in fact, you actually gave a talk. It was in 1987 regarding the political economic construct of gay male identities. The idea of political and economic constructs with gay male identities it just struck me as being very interesting. And in the conference, you talked about homosexuality, which homosexuality. Can you tell us a little about that talk and some of your thoughts along those lines?
Well, that was a conference in Amsterdam, an international conference of gay scholars. So that the homosexuality, which homosexuality, was the title of the conference. My own talk was, the title is somewhat Marxist in a way. But what I'm reacting to mostly in the talk is something called social construction theory, which nobody can explain it well, but it was a rather silly fad that a lot of scholars and a lot of gay scholars fell into in the 80s. I'm for traditional scholarship, which means, basically sort of thing I do. But I was taking a simple point, saying unless of all of this verbalizing that the social constructionists do, blah, 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 but, they never really say anything that you can get your hands on. Of just saying that gay male identities, in a lot of ways, are determined by things outside us, by, like, the gay sex industry. And I took a few examples of it, and I took the very simple one of paupers, nitrite inhalants. And through a brilliant advertising campaign, the paupers industry persuaded hundreds of thousands of gay men that a necessary part of their gay identity, of being gay, was to inhale these noxious chemical fumes, which have all sorts of terrible health hazards. I mean, it's ridiculous in a way. What is gay about, holding up a little bottle to your nose and inhaling it?
They were everywhere.
Yeah. Echoes, it's, you can go into a lot of my studies, and on my website I have the book that Hank Wilson and I published called Death Rush, Paupers, and AIDS. But if you talk to a biochemist, all you have to do is to describe what paupers are. I mean, they are a powerful oxidizing agent, meaning that they oxidize the blood, making it impossible to carry oxygen, causing severe anemia, which can kill someone. They are the most likely candidate for causing Kaposi sarcoma. Let me see, what else would I say? Peter Duisberg, who is a leading AIDS dissident, estimated that a gay man, after a night of, using paupers, that every cell in his body would be so impermeated with nitrite that according to the Food and Drug Administration laws, that his body could not be sold legally as meat. In other words, wow. These days don't like meat.
Period.
Has, nitrites in it, which are not good for you. Although bacon is, trivial compared to the amount that you would get in a session of paupers.
Interesting. So many things. You weave an interesting story the way these things tie together. We brought up the new gay conservatism, and you reviewed that. I'm trying to understand it. It seems to be one of the things that really struck me as an anomaly is that they include Signorelli as being a conservative. Of course, he does an LGBT conversation or talk radio show also, and it seems to me that it addresses the whole gay conservatism thing, and what does that mean? What are your thoughts on being gay and conservative, or is it tied to the left? Is it tied to the right? What is that about?
Well, of course, that was the author of the book I was reviewing who considered him a conservative. The more I think about these labels, the less simple they seem. In some respects, if people tell the truth, and if they believe that sex between guys is a good thing, and if they believe in freedom, things like that are to me far more important than when somebody is on the left or right end of the spectrum. In terms of the current situation, I think it's crucial that we change our foreign policy, get out of Afghanistan, Iraq, and that we don't attack Iran. The entire spectrum, there are people who oppose to the wars on the left and some on the right and some in between. So it's not all as simple as it used to be.
That's very true. It's certainly not. What is your estimate of the current situation regarding the upcoming elections? And of course, Arizona, California, and Florida, all three will have a constitutional amendment to be voted on that would limit marriage to being between a man and a woman. At least in the last election, and probably the election before that, the whole thing about gay folks was huge in driving out the ultra-conservatives to the voting booth. How do you think that will play in this year's election?
I don't know. Sometimes I just try not to think about it. I mean, in the primaries, I voted for Ron Paul, who was so far above the others in terms of principle and intelligence. But he's not going to be a candidate, so... As far as the gay marriage thing goes, for many years I said that the first priority of the gay movement should be repeal of the sodomy statutes. Well, eventually that happened, not, simply through the Supreme Court. And it didn't happen for the right reasons. It used sort of fuzzy liberal notions of privacy, but it ignored the key issue, which was the First Amendment, which forbids the establishment of religion, and that the sodomy statutes, making it a crime for two guys to have sex together, are purely and simply a codification of the Holiness Code of Leviticus, and so therefore they were always an establishment of religion, which is forbidden by the First Amendment.
Interesting. I have to ask in looking at all of these things. It's all terribly interesting. And you pointed out your website. I need to tell you that we are posting links to your website in the chat room, but there are listeners who, of course, are not in the chat room. So you'd probably like to tell them what that website is.
Okay. Best way is to give my personal website. You go through the first thing, http://, that's always it. Then it's Pagan Press Books, PaganPressBooks.com. And that's one word, PaganPressBooks.com. And then a slash, and then JPL. That's for John Philip Lauritsen.
I wondered what that said.
Pagan Press.
And your books offered on that site for sale, or does one need to go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble?
Well, my books are on sale mainly through Amazon, through Callum's Books in Boston, and they can be ordered directly. I mean, I don't have anything like PayPal or anything like that. I don't have the expertise to do it. So people would simply have to send in a check, The benefit would be free postage, because I don't charge postage if they directly. And
well,
the other thing is, greatly appreciate if you or someone were to put in library acquisitions request to you know, not a tiny library, but say a university library would be entirely appropriate for the man who wrote Frankenstein.
I should think so. How is that book doing on Amazon and some of the other sellers? Is it being, if it was reviewed in Salon, there must be some attention being called to it.
Well, originally it sold, you know, very, very well. Sales have tapered off, but this is a book that will be in print for many years. I don't expect it to be a bestseller at this point, but it's, I'm still, well, I still have things in store, you know, in terms of carrying forward my argument on authorship and the other things. So I expect sales to go up and down for many years.
Well, I have to say, John, you've been a wonderful guest. Certainly, if you're like me, I'm 55, and I often tell the folks who listen that I'm staying up well past my bedtime in order to do the show. But we appreciate your sticking with us this evening and telling us about this. And thank you so much for volunteering your time for Strictly Confidential. I've found it to be a very interesting interview.
Well, I'm afraid I'm a great deal older than you are. My last birthday, I said to a friend of mine, well, I'm still on the sunny side of 70. And he said,
that's
one way of looking at it. The other would be that you have just gone in the first day of your 70th year. So, anyway, that's where I'm at.
Well, congratulations, and may you do many more. And this book, The Man Who Wrote Frankenstein, that was only published last year. Are you working on another book?
Well, my long-term project is would be titled something like Male Love in the Shelley Byron Circle. And I've touched on some of it in my personal website under Love in the English Romantics. But it's a huge topic. I keep finding more and more and more information, all of which the numbskulls in academia were, maybe they're not all let down, maybe they're simply dishonest. But they, all these years, they have simply turned the other way of the type of homo eroticism that's there everywhere in the lives of the Romantics and also what they wrote. Long time.
Fascinating. Well, you certainly have a long background of looking at these things, and you've been through a lot. I've got to tell you, when I realized all the accomplishments and things you've done today, I thought to myself, my stars, how am I going to even begin? We appreciate your joining us this evening, John.
Oh, I've enjoyed being here.
Thank you, and good evening to you, sir. Folks, that is John, and that's John Lauritsen, and you can find out more about John at his website. It's Pagan Press Books. That is one word, paganpressbooks.com/JPL. And it is a site that's organized simply so it's easy to get to the various aspects of it, including feminism, AIDS, free thought, male love amongst the Romantics, gay liberation, the books. It's you'll find it fascinating. I did. I spent most of the day looking through the site and reading about John Lauritsen, who comes to us by way of one of our regular listeners, which is just to show you we have some most interesting listeners who bring us some of the most interesting guests. Glenn, of course, brings us music guests, but there are lots of other listeners, too, who have sent some wonderful guests our way. And in each case, I've always been fascinated by them. We've been rambling on for a good little while now. So what we'll do is we'll go to a break, and I will introduce this track because it was my request. And you recall when Debbie Jacobs was on the show, a fascinating music guest. We ran about a 3-minute clip of one of her tracks called Forever, which was actually recovered from cassette tape. A very special track back in the day, but not really released. And we had more than one listener, actually, who had requested to hear the entire track. And so Glenn sent that along to us. And And we're going to listen to that now and go to our top of the hour break at 10:13. So Bob will roll the track Forever, Debbie Jacobs, the full length. Roll it, Bob.
I've been looking at people, how they change with the time. Lately, all I've been seeing are people throwing love away and losing their mind. Maybe it's me who's gone crazy, 'cause I can't understand why. All these lovers keep hurting.
He's back! Riding across America on a horse named Strictly Confidential. A man who knows his way around a pair of chaps. Here's your host, Peter Godbold!
I am befuddled with this particular report. Queer Atlanta radio show receives $5,000 grant. Hello? No? What have I been doing all this? Yes, indeed, they did. The program is called Alternative Perspectives, and it is the only radio show in Atlanta specifically for the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered audience. Sound familiar? Well, they received a $5,000 grant from the Lloyd Russell Foundation. How about that? The Betty Couvetier says she is grateful to the Lloyd E. Russell Foundation for their vision and for the caring of the community and support for the work of the LGBTQ community. She is the creator and producer of the show, and it airs Tuesday evenings on the community-run WRFG 89.3. FM radio. So she does a show once a week on Tuesday evenings and gets a $5,000 grant. I don't begrudge her, but, you know, honestly, people, what's going on? The donation will enable WRFG to literally keep the lights on a while longer and continue broadcasting, and we'll continue to bring progressive information with programming such as Alternative Perspectives, she said. Now, Alternative Perspectives includes programming such as She Speaks and Pride in Politics, and there's a new segment on the show called Same Gender Marriage Blast with Ghetto Gospel, and on the third Tuesday of each month, the show features Tea Talk Tuesdays, which is devoted to transgender issues. Gee, that sounds like just a standard week on Strictly Confidential. The show also features an ongoing series, Faith-Based and Politics. Well, I'm sure they do a wonderful job doing it, but, you just have to shake your head and wonder. You know, God bless them, though. The grant's namesake, and this brought back many memories. The grant's namesake is Lloyd Russell. It came from the Lloyd Russell Foundation. Now, Lloyd Russell owned the old gay bar in Atlanta called The Cove. And Lord have mercy, I have spent many an hour dancing at The Cove. This was back in the 70s. That was a fabulous bar. In any case, he was a colorful gay activist. And in 1998, he unsuccessfully ran for governor of Georgia as a libertarian. He died back in March of 2006. But isn't that a small world? That's what we need to do, Bob. We need to cut back to one show a week and condense it all, and then we'll get a grant. I almost guarantee you. I'll tell you this story, too. And this comes from South Carolina. It happened Sunday, a couple of weeks ago. I meant to bring you this story earlier, but with the, the DSL down and the creek rising and the rodents scratching at the door and the alligators barking in the background, we didn't get to it. But in any case, I'll tell you about it now. An 18-year-old man returned home in South Carolina. He returned home from a gay pride parade, and he was assaulted by his father. Now, according to the Anderson County Sheriff's Office, the battering took place at about 1 p.m. Sunday on T Street. And during the assault, the teenager's 49-year-old father yelled and cursed and swung a baseball bat. He prayed and tried to cast the demon of homosexuality out of him. I'm sure a Louisville slugger will do just that. That was according to the teenager's version of events. The happened about 2 p.m. Wednesday. The teenager said his father punched him when he returned to the house for clothes that he left on Sunday. Apparently, there was got punched again when he came back for his clothes. The teenager told the deputy that his father has a problem with him being gay, and that's why he hit him with a baseball bat. The teenager filed both complaints. Way to go, kiddo. Interestingly enough, deputies have not been able to make immediate contact with the teen's father. Well, don't you just wonder why? Bob, I just noticed in production, he says we're the Rodney Dangerfield Memorial Network. We get no respect. Well, we do appreciate the support that you do send this way. And, of course, as Bob tells you, and now I will tell you, it is important to keep the lights on and the computers and the paid for and the toll-free lines and broadband T1 line and, you know, my wardrobe, Bob's tomato. And you can help with all that by stopping by the headonradionetwork.com and clicking on the PayPal button to keep Strictly Confidential up and running. We also thank Cold River Mountain Watch. And we are looking for anyone who has a $5,000 grant to send our way, because we don't do it just on Tuesday nights, honey. We do it as many days a week as we can possibly do it, provided that there's some internet service. I want to tell you a brief story here about Rick Santorum. He's got his panties all in a wad about gay marriage again. Dear friend of marriage, he says, my friend, I have never come to you with a more urgent message. Unless we act today, we will lose the battle for marriage. Not a decade from now, not someday, but quite possibly in the next few months. Dun, 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 dun. How? Well, just a few weeks ago, a handful of out-of-touch judges overturned the will of the people in California by repealing Proposition 22, which defined a marriage as the union between one man and one woman, and was overwhelmingly approved by the voters in 2000. Well, there's been some water under the bridge since then, but never mind that. He says four California judges endorsed two big, very bad ideas. First, they extended the internationally recognized human right to marry to include same-sex marriage, not even in Massachusetts or in New Jersey would the courts stomach the idea that the same-sex marriage is deeply rooted in our foundational American tradition. You see, none of this makes any sense. I'm reading it word for word, of human rights. You know, they always go non-sequitur. I mean, after they attack the activist judges, it immediately goes all non-sequitur and all over the map. It's impossible to interpret. The Republicans, of course, just sit and nod their heads and go, yeah, yeah. The second idea that was endorsed by the California court is even less promising. Sexual orientation should be treated just like race under the California Equal Protection Amendment. Well, and like religion is treated, too. You know. So, he says, the ruling that if it's left undisturbed means that Protestants and Catholics and Jews and Muslims, oh, now they're including the Muslims. Gee whiz, I thought they were the terrorists. The Jews and the Muslims and the Catholics who see marriage as a union of a husband and a wife and view sexual activity as best confined to marriage, so defined, they are now in the exact position as racists under the California law. Well, praise Jesus. I think that's absolutely fabulous. Couldn't be happier. Let's see here. Stacks of news that... Oh, I need to follow up on this story. Remember a long, long time ago I told you about the lesbians on the island of Lesbos? And remember they were suing to win back the name lesbian, because that's what you are if you are from the island Lesbos, and indeed I have no argument with that. Indeed, just what you are if you're from the island. But apparently we stole the name, and so in any case, the Greek islanders have lost the lesbian case, A Greek court on Tuesday ruled a gay rights group can use the name lesbian, saying people from the Aegean island of Lesbos did not have sole claim to the name. And it was a group of islanders from Lesbos. They filed a suit against the homosexual and lesbian community of Greece in April, the whole community, accusing it of insulting locals who are also called lesbians. How dare you call yourself a lesbian? I mean, this is just too funny. Oh, my. They insulted our historical and geographical identity by using the name. And the islanders were seeking to have the group barred from using the word lesbian in its name. And the Greek court ruled against the islanders, saying they did not have sole claim to the name. There's a magazine that's published on ancient Greek religions and who says that they're lesbians, and the islanders are going to take their complaint to the international court if need be. Boy, this is like our game that some of us play here on the Head On Radio Network, the Free States, the Nation something. Bob will remind me in a moment. There's a website, and you can go to it, and you can run your entire own country. And this sounds like something that would happen there to appeal to the national court on the, yes, Nation States. Thank you, Bob. It's nationstates.net if you'd like to stop by. That sounds like something that would happen in nation states. The word lesbian has been associated with gay women for the past few decades, but we've been lesbians for thousands of years. And Lesbos, of course, was the birthplace of the 7th century poet Sappho, who tradition says killed herself by jumping off a cliff over an unhappy love affair. And many of her poems contain passionate references to love for other women. And just thought I'd let you know about that. What we'll do at this point is run our Gay Bar Across the Street segment. Our Gay Bar Across the Street segment this evening is actually very, very good. You're going to like it. Some of the best mixing I've heard from anyone. And it's not done by one of our DJs, it's done by Hot Tracks. Now, you folks have heard me talk about DiscoNet to the point that your eyes glaze over when I start talking about DiscoNet. Hot Tracks was another DJ service back in the day, and in fact, DiscoNet has faded away into legend, but Hot Tracks has survived on into the digital age, and Hot Tracks actually has a site. They don't call it Hot Tracks, it's SelectMix.com. SelectMix.com is where you'll find the Hot Tracks DJ services. And this particular one is a retro remix done by Hot Tracks. And it's absolutely fabulous. And, so we'll gather up our umbrellas and our raincoats and our pocketbooks and our put on our stiletto heels, and we'll wander across the street to the gay bar where we will hear Hot Tracks retro.
Across the alley was the Paradise Dance Hall. Evenings in spring, they'd open all the doors and windows and the music would come outside. Sometimes they'd turn out all the lights except for a large glass sphere that hung from the ceiling. It would turn slowly about and filter the dusk with delicate rainbow colors.
L'imaginaire du jockey qui part en expédition dans la quatrième dimension.
Blood.
there you have a gay bar across the street segment brought to you by Hot Tracks. Just some of the most amazing mixing I have heard in quite a while. It just doesn't get any better than that. Hot Tracks, and you can find out more about Hot Tracks over at selectmix.com. And Hot Tracks has been around just forever. Back when I was even a little baby DJ crawling around the gay bars in my diapers, we had Hot Tracks even back in the 80s, along with Disconet and some other wonderful DJ remix services. Again, congratulations to the LGBT radio show on Tuesday nights that runs just on Tuesday nights in Atlanta, Georgia. They got a $5,000 grant. Way to go. It doesn't end, though, on the Head-On Radio Network. We are hardly at the end of our programming week. Be sure and stay tuned with us tomorrow afternoon around 5-ish for Rick Smith. His show starts around 5-ish on Saturday evenings, and then that follows with Rick's Place. Rick is the horn psychiatrist, of which we all need his services badly. He is Rick Goodner, and that will follow by Billy Shears with Night Sounds, and Night Sounds normally begins around 9 p.m., and some of the most amazing eclectic music you have ever heard happens on Night Sounds on Saturday night. So, no, the others go dead on the weekends, and we're still running live programming. You can help support the Head-On Radio Network by stopping by headonradionetwork.com, and there you'll find the PayPal button. And the PayPal button will allow you to contribute a monthly amount or a single donation, whatever fits in your budget to keep Strictly Confidential and the horn section and all the other programs that I'm leaving out to keep the Head-On Radio Network functioning as it normally does. And I want to thank the, often forget to do this, thank the News Ninjas who are in constant pursuit of the truth, and thank you for sending us the news articles. You just never know what to expect. We couldn't do this show without you, or any of the other shows for that matter. And thank you to our chat moderators who keep the chat room between the lines, and they do a wonderful job of it. So, I've enjoyed this evening, and I'm glad you could be with me. This is Strictly Confidential, and here's Cynthia Manley reminding you, too.